Parshas Vayera begins in what seems to be a most peculiar manner. The Torah tells us, Vayera Alav Hashem Belonei Mamre, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him, namely to Avraham, in the place of Mamre, and Vehu Yoshev Pesach HaOhel Kechom Hayom, at a time where Avraham is sitting at the entrance to his tent. What's particularly puzzling about the verse is that the Torah tells us that God appears to Avraham, but doesn't tell us any purpose for this appearance. Normally, when God appears to any particular person in the Torah, it says that God appears to him, and then it tells him a particular message. And this is the place that you find that this doesn't happen. Vayera Hashem Elav, God appears to Avraham, and then the next verse tells us that Avram all of a sudden notices that there are three people who are walking by, and he goes to be machnis orchim, he goes to welcome them. So Rashi quotes the Medrash, which is found in the Gemara as well, that asks this question, why is it that God appears to Moshe if in fact he doesn't give him any particular message? And Rashi writes that the purpose of this visit is levaker es hachola, that this is levaker es hachola, that this was a time that Avraham was ill, because at the very end of the previous parsha, Lech Lecha, Avraham is commanded on the mitzvah of Mila, on circumcision. And he performs this at the very end of last week's Kriyas HaTorah. As a result, he is very weak, he is very ill, and that's the significance of Vayera Alav Hashem, that God comes to him at this point, Levaker Es HaChola, to visit him because he is sick. With no particular message at this point, no particular new prophecy to give him, merely to come and visit him because he is ill. It seems even technically in the words of the verse that this seems to be certainly true. Because normally speaking, whenever you begin a new chapter of the Torah, you always find that it begins with a proper noun. It doesn't use a pronoun. Vayera Elav means that God appeared to him. It doesn't say to Abraham. Why does it use the term to him? It must be to tell you that somehow this is a connection of the previous chapter. The previous chapter was telling us that Abraham was the one who did a bris milah, he did circumcision, and God appeared to him in order to see, in order to try to heal him. So this is a tremendous mitzvah that you find, the Gemara says, in Nedarim, Daf Mem and Aleph, and this is the mitzvah of Bikur Chol, in visiting the sick. The Gemara explains in Sota and Daf Yudaud and Aleph, that the Torah tells us that we have to try to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have to try as best as we can to try to duplicate those things that we see God does in the world. This is the obligation of V'halachta B'drachav. We're obligated to walk in God's ways. So therefore the Gemara says in Sota, Machu Rachum, Achata Rachum. Just like God we know is a merciful God, so too we have to try to attempt to be of that nature as well. And Mahu Mevaker Chola, just like God went out of his way to see to it that Abraham was healed and visited the sick, so too this is true of us, that there is an obligation of Bikur Cholim. There is one view, and that is the opinion of the Bahag, the Halachos Gedolos, one of the early commentaries, the early of the Rishonim, to compile a Sefer HaMitzvot, where he lists what are the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. So among them, the Bahag counts the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, that this is a biblical imperative. If we see in this parsha that HaKadosh Baruch Hu visited Avraham with no message, but simply to visit him because he was ill, so too this is an obligation min HaTorah for us as well. The Rambam seems to disagree to some extent. When the Rambam quotes these laws of Bikur Cholim, he does so in the 14th chapter of Hilchos Avedos, and there the Rambam tells us that the particular obligation of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick, is only a rabbinic one. But as the Rambam himself seems to say elsewhere in the Sefer HaMitzvos, and as other Rishonim argue, that doesn't mean that it has no source in the Torah whatsoever. The Torah tells us, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. The Torah obligates us to love your neighbor as you do yourself. The Torah obligates us, V'hasisa hayasha v'hatov, A person is obligated to do that which is right, to try to see to it how God runs the world. He is merciful, he visits the sick. The same is true of us. So when Maimonides writes that the obligation of Bikur Cholim is not found explicitly in the Torah, so he explains that means that there's no particular verse that you can cite that deals with Bikur Cholim itself, visiting the sick. But it is an obligation, a biblical obligation. For after all, this is one of the ways that you fulfill that general commandment of the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, of demonstrating love not only toward those in your immediate family, but toward any Jewish person as a whole. So this is what you find in the Kriyas HaTorah at the very beginning of the Parsha, a mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, of visiting the sick. The Gemara writes in Nedarim, this is found on Daf Mem Amud Aleph, that there are various components that you find in the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. One of them is Lefakeach al Tzarchei HaCholah, that a person should see to it that the needs of a sick person are taken care of. Whatever he needs at that particular time, whether he needs food, or whether he needs clothing, whether he has to be washed, whatever the particular instance is, that, the Gemara says, is the obligation of Bikur Cholim. The Gemara cites the story of Rabbi Akiva, who was visiting one of his students who was ill. And he actually did those normally very mundane activities of sweeping a floor and cleaning a room in order to do whatever was necessary on behalf of that sick person. The Gemara says it's not enough merely to visit, but you have to try to do whatever you can to make it more pleasant and to take care of any need that he will have. And that's part of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. In fact, the Gemara says in Nedarim Daf Mem that, let's say, for example, doctors tell you that you can't visit a particular patient, but you know he has certain needs that have to be taken care of. So taking care of those needs is also part of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, even if you will not come in contact with him at all. So this is one of the components of this mitzvah, to see to it that you do whatever you can to make it more pleasant for him, to heal him if possible. That's what God did when he came to Abraham. He actually healed him. For us, to make his illness as easy for him as possible, to make sure at least he has the Yishuv Hadas, he has the knowledge that things that are troubling him are taken care of. And then the Gemara says in Nedarim that there's another very important component, and that is tefillah. That a person is obligated levakesh rachamim al hachola. That when you go visit someone, you have to make it as pleasant for him as possible, psychologically to cheer him up, but even physically to take care of anything that has to be done. And equally as important, the Gemara says, is that you have to be mispalel, that you have to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to do whatever he can to make this person well. And this is what's quoted in the Shulchan Aruch. It's found in Yaradei and Simin Shin Lamed Hei, that a person, when he visits someone who is sick, is obligated to help him, and just as important, obligated to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he make the recuperation period as easy as possible. And this is what a person is supposed to do. This is what the Gemara says also in Shabbos and Daf Yud Beis, that tefillah is an inherent part of Bikur Cholim. And the Gemara points out that it shouldn't only be for that particular Chola, but it should be for all Chola Yisrael. We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should heal this individual and Shar Chola Yisrael, that it should apply to everyone as well. So these are two very important components that you have to know. And this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling us in the Torah in the beginning of the Parsha. We know that Abraham was sick. He was sick because he was obligated to perform the mitzvah of Bris Milah, and therefore God made a special effort to visit him, to show us that there's an obligation, a biblical obligation of Bikur Cholim, and that Bikur Cholim means to see to it that his needs are taken care of. And for us, a crucial component of Bikur Cholim is tefillah as well. We ask that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should give this person a refuah shlema, b'sof chole Yisrael. Okay, so this is the mitzvah that we have. Why was it that Avraham was ill? It's because, as I mentioned, that he performed Bris Milah. A painful process, certainly, at that age, and therefore there was a recuperation period. This is what the Gemara tells us in Shabbos as well, right? This is found on Daf Kuf Lamed Hei, that if you have a baby who has just undergone a Bris Milah, that baby is considered to be a chola. It's considered to be in the state of a serious illness. And therefore, if necessary, of course, you're allowed to do whatever is necessary in order to reassure, in order to make certain that the baby will recuperate properly. So in the time of the Gemara, it was thought, it's a question whether this is true today, but in the time of the Gemara, it was thought that in order to make sure that there is no infection, the way they would handle it in that time was to make sure that the baby was cleansed properly and that hot water was used. This is what the Gemara tells us in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Lamed Hei. So therefore, the Gemara says that let's say a bris is on Shabbos. So certainly if a bris is on Shabbos, you do whatever you have to do in order to assure that the bris takes place on Shabbos. But even the Mishnah says if a bris is on Thursday, you're still allowed to do things on Shabbos in order to see to it that the baby recuperates properly. This is what that first Rashi quotes in the Parsha, that this was Yom Shlishi Lemilasa. You find in the Torah that this was the third day after the bris milah of Abraham. So therefore, the Mishnah says that apparently you see that anyone who undergoes a bris milah is in a state of peril, a state of satana, for a three-day period. And therefore, a person is allowed to do things even on Shabbos, not only on the day of the bris milah, but even the subsequent days as well. In fact, there's an interesting question which is raised in Shulchan Aruch, that normally speaking, if a child is born, so the bris milah always occurs on the eighth day. If a child is born on Shabbos, the bris milah occurs on Shabbos. Sometimes, however, this is impossible. If the baby is not well, or if doctors feel that at this point the baby's blood is not circulating properly, or the bilirubin is not quite right, so therefore they'll tell you to wait an extra week and to do the bris milah a bit later. So there was one view in Shulchan Aruch which is found, and many Sfarim follow this view, and that is that whenever you do a bris milah, if it's at its proper time, so you obviously do it at its appropriate time. What happens if you can't do it on the eighth day? You have to do it on the ninth day, the tenth day, the 11th day, any time after the eighth day. So we know that you can't do it on Shabbos. Because normally speaking, a bris milah, that action is forbidden on Shabbos. So if you do it on the eighth day, so the Torah says, you do it on that day irrespective of whether it's Shabbos or whether it's not. But what happens, for example, if the earliest possible time you can do a bris milah is on a Thursday? So there's one view which is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, it's found in Yoredei and Siman Reish Samach Vav, that you cannot do that bris milah on Thursday. Why? Because if you do a bris milah on Thursday, that means that the child will be in a state of sakana. He will be very sick even on the Shabbos for a three-day period. And therefore it will be necessary on that Shabbos to do things for that child. So therefore, many members of the Sephardic community still practice this way today, that if the earliest possible time that a bris can be performed is on a Thursday, they will wait until Sunday to do it. They won't do it on Thursday or Friday, because if they do it at that point, that means that the child will be in a state of sakana. The child will be very sick on Shabbos. And therefore, it may necessitate that we have to do certain things on Shabbos that, normally speaking, we shouldn't do. So therefore, some are of the opinion that you wait until that point. We normally don't assume this way l'halacha. We assume that just as a bris milah, if it falls on Shabbos, it is done on Shabbos. The same is true of a milah shelo bizmana. That even if a milah is done after the eighth day, you do it at the first opportune moment, unless it happens to be a Shabbos. Right? In certain communities, you find that people feel that if you have a bris milah, that it's, and you're not doing it on the eighth day anyway, so then it doesn't really hurt if you wait a few more days. Wait till the next Sunday, because after all, if you wait till Sunday, more people can come and it's much more convenient. The Noda Yehuda writes in his Tshuvas that you know that on Erev Pesach, a Bechor is supposed to fast. So it's difficult to do so. And it says in Shulchan Aruch, if there happens to be a Sudas Mitzvah, so then anyone who attends that Sudas Mitzvah, that festive meal, does not have to fast. So we have the whole process down pat. We always make sure that there's a Siyum, that someone finishes a certain book of the Talmud at that time, and everyone participates in the Siyum. So Noda Yehuda writes in his day, people didn't used to do that, but they had another practice that he thinks is terrible. And that is that they used to always make sure to have a bris on Erev Pesach. So if Erev Pesach was the eighth day, then they had it. What happens if it didn't work out? It was a small town. So he writes that there are people who, whenever they had a mila shelo bismana, once the doctor said that you can't do it on the eighth day, the baby is not well. So if it was at all close, it was in a week or within 2 weeks, they used to postpone it until Erev Pesach, and that's when they used to have the bris. And he writes that that certainly can't be done. It's interesting that the Dvar Avraham writes that when it comes to a regular bris, the Torah says any time on the eighth day. Yom Hashmini Yima Basar Alasa. A bris should be done during that day. So any time that you do it on that day, you fulfill the obligation. There is what the Talmud tells us, Rizim Matimim LeMitzvah, that people who do a mitzvah at the first opportunity, the earlier the better. So therefore, if you can do it in the morning, do it in the morning. And that's what we try to do. However, he writes, when it comes to Amila Shalom Bismana, when you're not doing it on the eighth day, so there's no verse in the Torah that says you can do it all day. You have to do it at the first moment possible. And he writes, this was his practice, in many communities in Europe they used to do this, that when you had a mila shelo bismano, they used to do it at the earliest moment, at sunrise they used to do the bris. Because they felt they didn't even wait a moment. If this was the first opportune moment, that's when they used to do it. So this is our practice, that we try to do even a mila shelo bismano, even if it's not the eighth day, we try to do it as early as possible. But there is one view that some members of the Sephardic community have, and that is that if a mila shelo bismana falls out on a Thursday or on a Friday, they do not do it. And the source is from this week's parsha, that if Avram was in a state of sakana, he was so sick, for even 3 days after the bris mila, so that means that a person should not undergo bris mila 3 days before Shabbos. So if that's the mitzvah to do, that's the eighth day, then do it. But if it's not the eighth day, then in some communities, they wait. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that he thinks this is true of elective surgery. But let's say a person knows he has to go into the hospital. And all things being equal, if the doctor tells you you must have surgery right away, so no questions asked. Of course you do it. You can even do it on Shabbos. But let's say it's an elective procedure. And let's say a person has a choice of what day it can be performed. So then, what Babichi Rebbe writes in his Tshuvas, as well as Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, that he thinks that this should be a consideration, that a person should try to do it at the beginning of the week, and not do it at a time that will necessitate that he be in the hospital on Shabbos, first because it will mean that those who care for him have to do certain things on Shabbos, and secondly, he writes, that's not the proper Oneg Shabbos, to cause pain to yourself during the Shabbos day. So if you don't have a choice, then of course there's nothing to speak of. But he writes, if you have an option, so you see from that Mishnah, that Kuf Lamed Hei and Shabbos, and from the beginning of this week's Parsha, that the person should try to space it as much as possible before Shabbos itself. So this is what you find at the very beginning. The mitzvah that Avram had of Mila, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's response of Bikur Cholim. The mitzvah of Mila certainly applies to us, and also, we have a biblical obligation of Bikur Cholim as well. This is an obligation which characterized the very personality of Avraham. You see throughout the parsha, both last week and this week, that Avraham was a person who was very dedicated to a sense of chesed, and not merely satisfied with his personal performance of a mitzvah, but trying to do whatever he could to see to it that everyone else fulfills mitzvos as well. We always say that Avraham personified the midah, the attribute of chesed, of mercy, of loving kindness, because Avraham tried to do whatever he could to be able to fulfill this mitzvah. In fact, this is what you find at the beginning of the parsha as well, that even though Avraham was so sick, and even though he was in great pain, nonetheless, when he saw that there were three people walking, and he didn't know who they were, he thought there were three Arabs who were simply walking near his tent. Nonetheless, he stopped, and he invited them in, and he made a feast for them. And this is another mitzvah that you find in the Torah, and this is Hachnas Asarchim. These are two mitzvahs that are mentioned at the very beginning of the parsha, Bikur Cholim, as well as Hachnas Asarchim. And the Rambam writes, as I mentioned, that even though you don't find explicit verses in the Torah that command you in a particular instance to do these particular things, these all fall under a general heading. If the Torah commands us, Ve'asisa v'yasha v'hatov, to do what is right, to do what is just, if the Torah obligates us, Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, to love your neighbor, so this entails a mitzvah bikur cholim, and this entails as well an obligation of hachnasas orphan. How different this is from what you find later in the parsha, and that is the city of stone. The city of stone serves as a stunning contrast from the actions of Avram on the one hand to their behavior on the other. Avram personified this attribute of chesed and loving kindness to such an extent that he did that even that he was not obligated to do. A person who is in a state of sakana, a person who is sick and who is not feeling well, a person whose life could be on the line, who just had surgery, is not obligated to leave his house to try to seek out guests. But yet, this was an obligation that Avram felt. Because it would appear that Avram felt that he had a mission, and that was not only to be satisfied with his own performance, but to transmit the word of God to others. This is what you find in last week's Kriya Satara, Ve'asanefesh asher asu b'chara, that Avraham actively went out and tried to transmit the word of God to everyone who he could. And this is the exact opposite of the reaction of Sodom and Amorah. Sodom personified a city that did not at all encourage or even allow any action ben adam l'chaverah. Any act of loving kindness between one person and another was forbidden in the city of Sodom. And that serves as an amazing contrast. Avraham, who believed in the virtues of ben adam l'chaverah, that a person can't be satisfied with his own action, but he has to have a firm belief and a firm grasp on communal responsibility as well, he is the one who is chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people. Sodom and Amorah, a city who despised and didn't allow any halachos, any laws that were manifestations of ben adam l'chaverah, that city was destroyed. And that is the contrast that the Torah tells us, to realize how crucial it is that not only is it necessary to observe the rituals of the Torah, but also to realize the significance of those obligations between man and his fellow man, hachnasas orchim and bikur cholim. And if you have a city that doesn't believe in it at all, so then the city had to be destroyed. And it doesn't necessarily mean even something which is so overtly terrible. You find in Pirkei Avos in the 5th chapter that if a person says, Shali shali v'shalcha shalcha, what is mine is mine and what is yours. So it says in Pirkei Avos that this is midas stone. This is a trait of stone. It doesn't have to be outright thievery. It doesn't have to be living in a nation which is so corrupt that obviously anyone would tell you that such a civilization cannot survive. But even if you live in a society whose motto is what is mine is mine, what is yours, even that, the Mishnah tells us, is considered to be a midas stone. This is something which the city of Sodom and Amorah were guilty of, and that's why the city was destroyed. And that's so very crucial to realize. When we speak about the obligations of chesed, when we speak about obligations of tzedakah, it's true that we somehow translate them of acts of loving kindness and merciful acts, but it shouldn't be interpreted to mean that it connotes something which is optional, something which is desirable, but something really which is not necessary. The Gemara tells us that this is very crucial. Rambam writes that the term tzedakah comes from tzedek. Tzedakah, charity, means tzedek, which means righteousness. It doesn't mean something optional. It doesn't mean something that is a midas chasidus, it's a pious act. It means something which is the very basic and very backbone of Jewish law. And even if you just have an attitude that I would not steal from anyone, that's certainly true, but I don't have an obligation to help others, to give of myself or to give of my funds, then the Gemara says that that's another example of midas dom. That is something that city was guilty of. What's amazing is, in spite of this contrast, in spite of the fact that Avraham believed so strongly in what he did, And in spite of the fact that he saw that Sodom was something that was diametrically opposed to his whole ideology, it's amazing the efforts that Avraham went through in the parsha to try to save the city of Sodom. Normally speaking, when a person believes in something so firmly, and the person has a particular adversary who's diametrically opposed to everything that he stands for, so when finally I emerge victorious and my adversary has a downfall, you wouldn't expect me to try to do everything I possibly could, even to risk my own self, in order to try to save that person's life. You would expect that this would be a victory in my court, that finally what I believe in, that is what is emerging as being true. That Avram, who personified Ben Adam, L'chaveiro, Chesed, righteousness, loving kindness, that is prevailing. And any city that doesn't believe in this is destroyed. But yet, Avram is not satisfied with that. He is so moved and he is so committed to this ideal that he even argues, so to speak, and struggles with God to try to save the city of Sodom. And you find an amazing dialogue that occurs in the parasha. It seems that Avram turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, turns to God and says, how is it possible you can destroy such a city? Shofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. You are the ruler of the world. How is it possible for you to do something that seems to be unjust? It's an amazing statement that you find in the Torah. Even many secular philosophers have quoted this in their analysis and political philosophy of whether you believe in a natural law or whether you believe in positive law. Why is it that we have to observe certain laws of the land? Is it because they reflect a certain moral ethic and therefore we are bound to that moral ethic? Or is it merely because, formally speaking, they were enacted? And since it's a law and you choose to live there, so obviously you have to abide by all the laws of the land. And how does the Torah feel about this issue? Do we fulfill mitzvot of the Torah merely because HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to do so? Or somehow is the fact that God commanded us to fulfill these mitzvot indicative of the fact that they reflect a moral and proper behavior? And therefore, that is our obligation. So it would appear from this verse that the Torah clearly believes to a large extent that there is a moral ethic. And God is telling, and Avraham is telling God that even you, so to speak, are bound to act in a moral way. Hashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. It's not right, it's unjust to destroy a total nation because there are members of that community who are wicked. This is what Avram challenges HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You see it happens another time as well. Our sages tell us that even in the end of the parsha, with the story of the Akedah, that Avraham was commanded to bring his son Yitzchak as a sacrifice. So there too, Avraham questioned to make sure that this is in fact what God had in mind. Do you really mean that I should take my son and offer him as a sacrifice on the Mizbeach? Avram wasn't afraid to question. He wasn't afraid to even ask of God that whatever is done, even by you, be done and be reflective of a moral ethic. This is what you find in the Kriya Sator of the Parsha. Even Avram, however, who questioned HaKadosh Baruch Hu to such an extent, there was one underlying factor which is very important for us. And that is, whenever you find that Avraham questioned, he wanted to know, why was it that you asked me to do this? How is it that you tried to destroy a city of Sodom and Amorah? What is clear is that when it came to the bottom line, when it came to the performance of the act, Avram was completely obedient. He did whatever God asked him to do, but that did not stop him from questioning. He asked, Hashofet kol aretz liyaseh mishpat. He tried to see if there was any way possible in order to save the city of Sodom and Amorah. But the bottom line was is that he accepted the decree of God when God said, after he couldn't find the righteous people, that it had to be destroyed. The same thing is true of Akedas Yitzchak. The Torah tells us that God says to Avram, Kachna es bincha es yichidcha asher ahavta es Yitzchak. It's a very cumbersome language. Take bincha, your son, yichidcha, your special son, asher ahavta, who is loved, take Yitzchak. And Rashi, as well as Chazal, are very bothered by this cumbersome choice of words. Why does this Torah simply say, Kach es Yitzchak, take Yitzchak, v'haleu sham le'ola, and Ephraim has a sacrifice to me? Why is it the Torah says, Kach no es bincha es yechidcha asher ahavta es Yitzchak? So Rashi already quotes what the Gemara tells us, that there was a struggle. Avraham knew that God told him, Ki v'yitzchak ikar lechazara, that your heritage, your beliefs will be transmitted not through you, but also through Yitzchak as well. And now all of a sudden, God tells him to take Yitzchak and to bring him as a sacrifice on an altar. So immediately Avram begins to ask questions. How is it possible? One of the principles that you recite in the davening right before Baruch Shamar is Rabbi Yishmael says that there are 13 principles which the Torah elucidates on. The Yud Gimel Midah Sha'atar Nidreshes Bahem. And one of them is Shnei Ksuvim Machishim Zeh. Sometimes you find two contradictory verses in the Torah. So this is what Avram was faced with. Avram was promised by God, Ki Yitzchak Yikar Lecha Zara, that Yitzchak will transmit your message and he will give rise to a great nation. And at the same time he is commanded, V'haleu sham li'ola, to take your son and to offer him as a sacrifice. How can this be? So this is the dialogue. God says to Avram, Kach no es bincha. So Avram responds, you tell me to take my son, you must be referring to Yishmael. For after all, I have more than one son. Yitzchak, you have already told me, he will give rise to a great nation. It must be referring to him. So then God tells him, no, Yechidcha, your special son. So Avram responds that all the sons are special. Each one is Yachid. One is unique to this mother, one is unique to the other mother. And God says further, Asher Ahavta, the son that you love. And Avram responds that he loves both of them dearly. Both of them are considered to be his children. And finally, God has to say, Es Yitzchak. Take Yitzchak. He is the one who is to undergo this Akedah. And once HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that, all the questioning stopped. It's very important for us to keep this in mind as well. There's no doubt, the Rambam writes in Mor Nevuchim, that each one of us has a right to question. Each one of us has a right to try to understand as much as possible what is it that God has in mind, what His divine vision is, and what He demands of us. What do you do when you look in the Torah and you see something that at first glance seems to you to be something that is inappropriate? It's not proper to turn away. It's not proper to ignore the problem. Avram tells us that you have to try to do whatever you can to try to resolve that belief. But the one requirement, and that is that once the law is stated clearly, that's the end of the discussion. In other words, the doubt is very valid in a theoretical sense, but a person has to see to it why he is fulfilling mitzvahs. Why is it that God asked us to perform this particular obligation and not something else? Why is it that if the Torah stands for such lofty ideals, why does it tell you this dialogue? Why does it tell us this chapter? But yet to realize that doubt which is cast in your own mind does not affect the bottom line fulfillment of mitzvahs. Avram tried to do whatever he could to understand. If God told me that Yitzchak will be my descendant, so now that he's telling me to slaughter my son, it must be referring to someone else. But once God made it clear that this is whom he had in mind, so then Avram didn't say, well, then I'm not going to do it. Avram felt that it was necessary to do. This is very important to know. We certainly believe, this is clear, this is what the Rambam writes, and this is what the Gemara tells us as well, that we don't believe that the mitzvos of the Torah are arbitrary. We don't believe that it so happened that God commanded us not to kill, and God told us we should try to do everything to sustain life. And that's just coincidental, that's arbitrary. God could have just as easily had told us the opposite, and we would have been bound to do it because he had said so. We believe clearly, as the Gemara tells us, that the laws of the Torah reflect a very important moral ethic. That the word of Hashem is just, it is emes, it is truthful, and it reflects moral precepts. Because Avram seemed to bind HaKadosh Baruch Hu to this. Shofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat. Even you, God, are obligated to act in a moral fashion. We certainly believe this is true. This is the whole attempt of Rishonim at understanding Tamei HaMitzvos. The Rambam writes at such great length, why is it that God gave us this particular mitzvah? Why is it he commanded us to do it in such a way? The whole underpinnings of that reasoning is that when God told us to do so, it was for a particular reason, to better ourselves in a particular fashion, and that is the purpose that mitzvot serve. Certainly believe that this is true, that mitzvot aren't merely a will of God, meaning and that it is void of any moral ethics. It's clear that mitzvot reflect that morality. And sometimes it's necessary for a person to struggle. Sometimes you may come across a particular obligation that coming from our setting and coming from our perspective seems to rub us the wrong way. And to this legitimate question, it's something that is worth raising, it's something that's worth asking. But what you see from the parsha is that there is a limit. That it can't affect the day-to-day functional obligations that we have. The Ramban even goes a step further. The Ramban tells us that every precept that God gives us is perfectly just, perfectly right, and perfectly understandable. When the Talmud speaks about a division that you find in the Torah between a chok and a mishpat, sometimes the Torah refers to principles as chukim, statutes. Other times the Torah refers to its laws as mishpatim. What is the difference between a chok, a statute, and a mishpat, a law? So the Gemara tells us in Yuma that a mishpat is that ilmali lo nechtav hayarashai la'omra, that even if it wasn't written, even if the Torah would say, person should not kill, it is something that we would have incorporated in the corpus of our laws as well. Even if the Torah did not tell us that we should not steal, it is something that logic would have dictated that should be part of any body of laws in order to allow for a civilization to rise. A chok, the Gemara says, is something which is very different. A chok is something which, if the Torah didn't write it, it is not something that we on our own would have incorporated into our body of laws. The Torah didn't tell us to keep kosher, so we would not have thought up on our own all the laws of kashrus. If the Torah didn't tell us that there are some requirements of shatan is not to wear different types of clothing made out of different materials together, it's not something we would have come up with on our own. This is certainly true. There are different types of precepts that you find. Some are called mishpatim, others are called chukim. Mishpat is something that intuitively we would have known on our own. A chok is something that intuition could not have helped us. We need a direct tzivui Hashem, a commandment of God, in order to tell us that this is what He demands of us. But the Ramban writes that you shouldn't make a mistake and think that mishpatim are logical and chukim are not logical. With the Gemara is simply making a sociological statement, what we could have known on our own. If we had divine wisdom, if we had the knowledge that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has himself, so the entire system makes sense. And there is a reason even for what we call chukim. There is a reason for kashrus, there is a reason for shatnez, there is a reason for every precept. The Gemara is just telling us that when we study, that and we look at these things, a priori we would not have included this in the system itself. This is what the Ramban tells us. Every precept that you find in the Torah is perfectly moral and perfectly just. And that is the premise with which we operate. It's important to question, it's important to study, because Ein Habay Shalomed, if a person doesn't do so, he's only cheating himself. If you don't ask, you're not going to find out, you're not going to discover. And that is very legitimate. That is what Abraham did in both instances in the Torah. He did so when it came to Sodom and Amorah. He questioned how it was possible to destroy a city. The same thing occurred with Akedas Yitzchak, that he questioned, how is it possible that God, you're commanding me to sacrifice a son? But yet, even the questions and even the struggle that Avram had to go through did not affect his devotion and did not affect his commitment. This is what the Rambam tells us in Moreh Nebuchim, that even if a person doesn't understand a particular mitzvah, and the Rambam even disagrees with that Ramban, the Ramban writes that every precept and every detail of a mitzvah can be explained on rational grounds. We may not fully understand it, but that's because the Ramban says our knowledge is limited. If a person has divine insight and divine knowledge, he could do so. And the Rambam, the rationalist, disagrees. The Rambam writes, this is true in a general sense. Mitzvos, in general, do reflect a moral ethic, are rational, and can be understood. But the Rambam writes in Moreh Nebuchim that particular details of a commandment, that is something which could go either way. The Rambam writes, there is a very good reason why God commanded us to wear tefillin. But why exactly tefillin is shaped in the particular fashion as it is, and not a little bit differently, that the Rambam says is merely because God commanded it as such. And why is that done? Because the Rambam tells us that God is telling us that obedience itself is an important ideal and an important virtue. That our perspective has to be that when we fully realize that this is what the Torah demands of us, that that is enough for us. That therefore we have to do so. And this God teaches us by putting in the Torah certain mitzvos which seem to be beyond reason. To tell us that you have to realize that the reason that you're doing this mitzvah is not because it makes sense to you. Not because if I was making a body of laws, I would have included this as well. But rather because Asher Kirishanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu, that God has commanded us to do so, and by creating that mitzvah, that is enough for us. This is the message which Avram tells us. It's very important to question. He does so in Sodom, he does so in the Akedah, but the underlying premise is that the questioning that he does is always done with great reverence, with the understanding that the purpose of questioning is to further understand. The purpose of questioning is to enhance our commitment, to enhance our appreciation. If a person understands what a mitzvah stands for, so then the fulfillment becomes so much more meaningful. But nonetheless, mitzvos are to be fulfilled even if understanding is not there. And that's why the Torah includes things which seem to us to be very foreign. Something which the Gemara says that if it didn't say so black and white in the Torah, it wouldn't be the type of law, the type of precept that we would institute on our own. So the clear message that we find is Avraham's belief that obedience is demanded and understanding is necessary as well. And the important responsibility we have to demonstrate that the precepts of the Torah are not to be viewed as in a vacuum, that this is what God demands of us, this is it. But the precepts of the Torah reflect a real sense of morality. The Torah tells us that V'ro kol amei ha'aretz, that the nations of the world should see in us an example, and they should respond by saying that the Torah is something which is so great, because they see its people acting in a moral fashion, they see the makeup and the nature of the Jewish community as a whole, and therefore the response should be that the Torah must be something which is great, If people are bound to a certain law, and that law mandates and dictates a certain behavior, so then this is what we're trying to accomplish. That v'ra'ukol amei ha'aretz, that everyone should see and they should be inspired. Because the Torah has something to offer which reflects the utmost sense of morality. This is clear from many indications of the Gemara as well. That built into the system of halacha, there are certain moral concepts as well. There is a notion of v'asisa hayashar v'hatov, doing that which is morally just. There is a notion of lifnim mishuras hadin, that even if, technically speaking, a person is entitled to something, sometimes the Torah demands of us to go above and beyond the call of duty. The Gemara says in Bava Metzia and Daf Lamed, Rav Yochanan says, because Shadanas Hadin Alpi Torah, that whenever they had a dispute, they used the Torah to solve the problem. So the Gemara says, what else should they have done? They should have used Din? That's what they did. They should have used some other body of law. So the Gemara says, no, this is what is meant. Shadanas Hadin Alpi Din Lo Nichnas Lifnim Mishuras Hadin. Whenever there was a particular case that arose, one person was claiming that another person owed him some money. So they would simply look in the books and they would stick to the letter of the law and completely ignore the spirit of the law. They would completely ignore the elements of Vasisa Hayasha Vahatov to do that which is moral and that which is just. And when you are trying to raise and trying to develop a society, it is certainly necessary to abide by all the letter of the law, certainly true. But the spirit of the law, the moral they broke something of their employer. So as a result, the employer made them responsible. They had to pay for it. And what he did was he even foreclosed on some of their property because the workers were very poor and they couldn't manage to pay for that which they broke. So Rav turned to this employer and said, you're obligated to give these things. They broke something of their employer. So as a result, the employer made them responsible. They had to pay for it. And what he did was, he even foreclosed on some of their property because the workers were very poor and they couldn't manage to pay for that which they broke. So Rav turned to this employer and said, "You're obligated to give these things back. You have no right to take these things away from the poor people." So Rav said, "Dina hachi, is this the halacha? Is this true? Doesn't it say if a person does damage to me, I'm obligated, I'm allowed to collect? Do you really say that that's true? Dina hachi?" So Rav says, yes, this is a halacha. Because the Torah tells us in Mishlei that a person is obligated, l'man telchu b'derech hatovah. A person is obligated to do that which is just. And the Balei HaTosfos from the Ravon means that sometimes you can force a person to act lifnim mishuras hadin, beyond the normal call of duty. It is true that especially when it comes to monetary issues, the Torah sets up a system of laws. But there is an obligation that we have, that everyone must always act lifnim mishuras hadin. A person must always see to it that his practice is something that is perceived as being moral and being just. And even if a person can somehow find a legal fiction, and technically speaking the law is on his side, if you do something which has with it the appearance of being something which is immoral, something which is not just, so the Gemara says not only is it wrong, but dina hachi, that it's not what the Torah is demanding of you. It's not that really, strictly speaking, the Torah says this is what's necessary. But you, as a measure of loving kindness, should act differently in order that people should see that you're a just and moral person. That it's not that this moral ethic of asisa hayasha vahato, doing that which is good and doing that which is just, is an independent ethic. But this is part of the demand that the Torah makes. And this is the thrust of the message of Parshas Vayera. It begins with an obligation of bikur cholim. It begins with an obligation of hachnasas orchim. It tells us what's found in the Kriyas HaTorah that God shows Avraham. Ki yedativ, for I know that you will be able to transmit a complete message, a message that any individual will be able to look at you and say that this is what I stand for. This is the message of the Torah. A person not only committed to ritual, but a person who is as equally committed to be krocholim, tachnasas orchim, committed to those elements that stom oppose the importance of ben adam lechavero as well as ben adam lemakom. Last time we finished discussing the mitzvah of Kiddush, let me just go through a few things that we discussed and then we'll go on to the topic of Havdalah. We pointed out that there is an obligation that you find of reciting Kiddush, and this is an obligation min HaTorah. It is based on the pasuk of Zachar Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, found in the happy two separate pieces. They have to be fused as one. If you think that religion is merely matters of ritual, the first five of the Aseret Dibros, but areas that relate to Ben Adam Lechavero is a completely separate domain, the Ramban says this is the message of the Aseret Dibros. 10 commandments with a division of 5 and 5, but fused and carved as one, to tell you that these areas, ritual and morality, must go together. The Rambam writes the Mishneh Torah very strong language. The Rambam says it's possible to have a person who is osa mitzvah, a person who does a mitzvah, v'tars v'no salafanav, and God rips it in his face. It's possible to have a person who is so religious, who does everything properly when it comes to ritual, but he is very weak when it comes to Bein Adam L'Chaveira. When it comes to issues of morality, those things don't conserve him. He's chosen to concentrate merely on ritual. So the Rambam writes, not only is he delinquent in Bein Adam L'Chaveira, but the Rambam writes, even the mitzvah has no reward. Tarfen also lefanav means that the Kadosh Baruch Hu views the mitzvah as if it's meaningless, as if it wasn't performed. The necessity that both of these components have to go together. To believe that of course God is the one who commanded us to fulfill the mitzvahs of the Torah. And that is why we do them. But the belief as well that they reflect a most perfect moral system. And that has to be implicit, and that has to be manifest in everything we do. If we act in a certain way that a person can point to us and say, we are religious Jews, but we're acting in an immoral fashion, so then the Rambam writes, not only is there a problem as far as mitzvahs bein adam l'chaveira, there is even a problem bein adam l'makom. Tarfen also, the fun of the Rambam says, means we don't even get schar for those mitzvahs we do. If the mitzvahs are accompanied by that other half of our personality, who acts completely immoral in every other sense. So this is the stunning contrast you find in the parsha. You have the personality of Avraham, who personifies both. His obedience to the law of God is complete, and yet his dedication to moral virtues and moral precepts is also perfect. That is what the Rambam tells us is his virtue. The other side is the city of stone. Stone which was weak not only in terms of its religious observance, but stone which was very weak in terms of its commitment to basic moral values. And the message that the Torah tells us, as the Ramban writes in Aseres HaDibros, that these have to be combined. You can't have one without the other. This is what Rav Soloveitchik has pointed out very often when it comes to the obligation of chinuch, of teaching our children and teaching others the mitzvah of the Torah. When the Torah gives us this commandment of chinuch, we're so used to thinking that chinuch means mitzvahs, because the Gemara says that chinuch means that before your son is bar mitzvah, you're supposed to teach him to take a lulav and esrog. Before your daughter is bas mitzvah, you're supposed to teach her to eat matzah on Pesach. But the Gemara says that's only part of it. Chinuch in mitzvahs is only rabbinic obligation. As Rashi writes, because when they become of age, bar bas mitzvah, they have to know how to do the mitzvahs. So don't wait until then. Don't tell a son and daughter at the time of their bar bas mitzvah, everything you've done up until now you were allowed to do, but from here on end you have to do everything differently. Now you have to start observing mitzvahs. That's a rabbinic obligation. But there's also a biblical obligation of chinuch, and that comes from Avram Avinu. If God tells Avram, ki yedativ for emo, I know, l'man asha yetzav espanav espeso achro v'shama b'derech Hashem. The Torah tells us in Parshas Ve'era, God says, I know that you will be able to raise a generation, to raise his son Yitzchak, and he will raise his son Yaakov, who will be able to follow my precepts, not the mitzvahs. The Taryag mitzvahs of the Torah, the 613 mitzvahs, were not even given yet. When God told Avram of this idea of chinuch, to transmit the message not only to yourself and to your family, but to subsequent generations, he wasn't merely speaking about the do's and don'ts. He was speaking about the basic understanding of what our mission is, about this fusion, the combination of the ritualistic elements as well as moral precepts. And that's why the Torah tells us that we have an obligation, Vodata levanecha levanevanecha, Yom asher amad lifnei Hashem lokecha b'chorev leimor. We have an obligation to tell our children and to tell each generation the experience of Har Sinai. Not merely the mitzvahs of Har Sinai, but the experience of Har Sinai. Because included in that experience of getting the Torah is not simply that you're obligated to this and forbidden to do that, but included in that experience is what it means to be moral, what it means to be just, what it means to be ethical. And this is the message that Avraham was able to transmit to generations. And that's why we find in the Kriyas HaTorah that God chose Avraham. Hiyagatir, for I know that you will be able to transmit a complete message, a message that any individual will be able to look at you and say that this is what I stand for. This is the message of the Torah. A person not only committed to ritual, but a person who is as equally committed to Bikur Cholim, Tachnasas Orchim, committed to those elements that Stom opposed, the importance of Ben Adam L'Chavero as well as Ben Adam L'Makom. Last time we finished discussing the mitzvah of Kiddush. Let me just go through a few things that we discussed, and then we'll go on to the topic of Havdalah. We pointed out that there is an obligation that you find of reciting Kiddush, and this is an obligation min ha-Torah. It is based on the pasuk of Zachar Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, found in the Aseres HaDibros, and implicitly the Gemara tells us that the term Zachar, remembrance, which you find in the Torah, means not merely to remember, but it means to make concrete, to do something, an action, which manifests that remembrance. We remember Amalek by having a special Kriyas HaTorah before Purim. And how do we remember Shabbos? By reciting Kiddush. So this is an obligation that we have. Last time we spoke about how is it, just in practical terms, that a person fulfills this obligation. What is necessary and what is not. So the Gemara tells us in Psachim that a person has to mention the special characteristics of Shabbos and also has to mention Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. That is the biblical obligation. We assume that making Kiddush on wine and drinking the wine is only Drabanan. The Torah doesn't mention anything about doing so on wine. That's just a rabbinic obligation. But a person is obligated on a rabbinic level to recite Kiddush as we do, and someone should drink the wine. Who is obligated to drink the wine and how much wine? Well, there are three views that you find in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Reish Ayin Aleph as to who has to drink the wine. The first view is that the Mevarech, the person who makes Kiddush, should drink the wine. The second view that you find in Shulchan Aruch is it doesn't have to be the person who makes Kiddush, but any one person who is present drinks the wine. And the third view is that if everyone takes a sip, and as a result, the wine has been consumed, that is sufficient. So we assume halachically it's best to do one of the first two. Either the person who makes Kiddush should drink the wine, or he can recite Kiddush and have someone else drink the wine. But one person should drink the prescribed amount of wine. What is that? So the Gemara tells us that you have to use a cup that holds a revius. A revius is anywhere between 3.5 ounces and 5.5 ounces. That's how large the cup should be. And a person is obligated to drink a rov revius, half of that. The way it's presented in Shulchan Aruch is, all you have to drink is a rov revius, regardless of how large the cup is. If you have an 8-ounce cup for Kiddush, you don't have to drink 4 ounces. All you have to drink is most a revius, 1.5, 2 ounces of wine. That's all you have to drink for Kiddush. There is a view that disagrees, and that's the view of the Ramban. And the Ramban writes that you always have to drink a rov kos. When the Gemara says rov revius, you should drink most of the revius. That's because the minimum amount that the cup should hold is a revius. But whatever the cup holds, you have to drink most of that. We normally don't assume that way lahalacha when it comes to Shabbos. But we do assume this way when it comes to dalet kosos on Pesach. That since the mitzvah at the Seder is to drink 4 cups of wine, so therefore you should drink the entire cup of wine, if you can, or at least most of the cup of wine. That's not true on Shabbos, though. As long as you, or another individual who is present, drinks a rov revius, approximately 2 ounces, that is sufficient. Also you find in Shulchan Aruch, and this is in Siman Reish Ayin Gimel, that there is a halacha that kiddush must be b'makom suda. It has to be in the place of a festive meal. The Gemara bases this on a pasuk which says, v'karasa l'shabbos oneg. When you declare that it's Shabbos, namely when you make kiddush, it has to be in the place of oneg, in the place of your festive meal. So therefore, kiddush has to be b'makom suda. It has to be in the place that you have the meal. That is why there is a major dispute as to kiddush Friday night in shul. How is it that you can make kiddush as part of the service on Friday night, for after all, we don't have a festive meal which is associated with it? So there is a view of Tosfos and the Rush who argue that that's true, that you don't recite kiddush in shul on Friday night. How did the minhag arise? Because in earlier times it was very common that if people didn't have a place to eat on Friday nights, they used to eat in the shul. So those who used to eat in the shul on Friday night used to recite kiddush. So therefore it became very popular to recite kiddush in shul, because for those people it was kiddush in the place at the time that they are eating. But the Rush writes that today, where people are not eating in the shul, so therefore you do not recite kiddush on Friday night in the davening. This is the Sephardic practice, that there is no such thing as kiddush to be incorporated as part of the Friday night davening. The one who disagrees with this is the Rambam. The Rambam writes that even though that's true, even though the reason that kiddush was instituted initially was because of people who used to eat in the shul, once it was instituted, it became part of the Friday night tefillah, the davening, and therefore it continues even today. For example, the Rambam says that in earlier times, people didn't have a sitter, and they didn't know how to daven. So therefore, it was necessary that the chazan had to repeat the Shemoneh Esrei, even though everyone in the community was supposed to have said it by themselves. So the Rambam writes, just like today, that everybody has a sitter, and in most circumstances, people are davening themselves, but still we require that the chazan repeat the Shemoneh Esrei. So too, the Rambam writes, this is true of kiddush. Even though the reason for its institution was because there were people who had to rely on that kiddush because they were having their meal in shul, once it became part of the body of the davening on Friday night, that practice is maintained. And we, of Ashkenazic descent, follow this view of the Rambam. And that is that we have kiddush in shul on Friday night. However, there still is a problem. Kiddush is supposed to be b'makom suda. It has to be in the place that you eat. And you're not supposed to eat anything before you recite kiddush. So who drinks the wine Friday night? So that's why it says in Shulchan Aruch, the best thing to do is to give it to a child to drink. That the chazan makes kiddush, and if there are children who are present, to give it to the child to drink. And if there are no children that are present, it says in Shulchan Aruch that the chazan himself can drink if he drinks a lot of wine. But that's considered to be b'makom suda, according to some, if he has a substantial amount of wine to drink. Okay, but this is the requirement of reciting kiddush. This obligation is on Friday evenings. To recite kiddush, all that's necessary is one person to drink. There is one view in Shulchan Aruch that says that even though it's not necessary, it's preferable that everyone should take a sip of wine. Really, all that's required is one person drink. But it's preferable that everyone should taste the wine. It's a kosher bracha. It's a cup of wine on which a bracha mitzvah was fulfilled. So therefore, it's preferable that you should pass around a little wine for everyone to taste. But if a person doesn't want to, he certainly doesn't have to, and he still fulfills the mitzvah of kiddush, because all that's technically required is that one person has to drink. Not only is there a mitzvah of kiddush, the Gemara says, but that should be the first thing that a person tastes on Shabbos. Once you declare that it's Shabbos, daven, or you light candles, or it becomes sunset, a person shouldn't eat anything until kiddush is recited. The kiddush should be the first thing that enters a person's mouth, the wine of kiddush itself. And the same we assume is true of the kiddush on Shabbos morning, that after a person davens, a person shouldn't eat anything until you have kiddush. And kiddush should be b'makom suda. It has to be in the place that you have your meal. So there's one view that says, this is the view of Tosfos and Psachim, who writes, that that means that Kiddush, Shabbos morning, has to be accompanied by your Shabbos lunch. But there are many others who disagree. And they argue that in order to have Kiddush on Shabbos morning, it's enough if you just have cake with it, mizonos with it, that's sufficient. So because of that view, many shuls will have a Kiddush after davening. And if a person has something to eat, they should have something a little bit more substantial. They should have cake with it, something to call it a meal, a Suda Shabbos, because Kiddush has to be b'makom Suda. One last thing we pointed out is that there's an interesting halacha somewhat unknown, and that is that we're all aware of the halacha that when a person makes a hamotzi, so hamotzi covers everything that you normally have in the course of a meal. When you make hamotzi on Friday night or Shabbos morning, so you don't make a separate bracha on the soup, and you don't make a separate bracha on the main course, but hamotzi is poter kol minei ochlin. It covers everything, every food that you have in the course of the meal. There is a similar halacha which is found when it comes to wine. That since wine is the most preferred beverage, so yayin is poter shamashkin. If a person makes a bracha bari pri agafen and drinks wine, and then he wants to have a glass of soda, so you don't make a separate bracha on that soda. Just like you don't make a bracha on food once you've recited hamotzi, you don't make a bracha on drinks once you've recited bari pri agafen. But it says in Shulchan Aruch that this is only true if you drink the wine. So it's important to know the halacha. Let's say after davening the rabbi makes kiddush. So whoever drinks the wine, if they will have a glass of soda, you don't recite a bracha of shahakol on that glass of soda. Because once you've already had wine, and wine is the most preferred beverage, you don't make a bracha on any other beverage at all. But let's say you don't drink the wine, because you don't have to drink the wine for kiddush. As long as the rabbi drinks the wine, that's sufficient. So if you don't drink the wine, then you must make another bracha of shahakol on soda which you will subsequently drink. But if you do taste the wine, even this very small amount, then you don't recite any other bracha on a shahakol. The same thing is true when it comes to the concluding bracha. There's a special long concluding bracha that is recited after a person drinks wine. And that bracha will cover every beverage that you have. You don't make a separate bracha achrona on soda or on water or any other beverage. Okay, so this is the obligation of Kiddush. Kiddush, the real obligation is just to recite it once on Shabbos. We do that on Friday night. The Kiddush that we recite on Shabbos morning is just a bracha bari pri hagafen. There are other customs to recite a little bit more, some other verses, but those are simply a matter of custom. All that is required is that you make a bracha bari pri hagafen and that you drink a couple ounces of wine. As I pointed out also, the Gemara says in Brachos and Daf Chav that this obligation of reciting Kiddush is one which not only men are obligated in, but women are obligated in that as well. And the Gemara says that this is an exception to the normal rule. That normally speaking, we assume that any positive commandment which is bound by time, women may fulfill them, and they may recite a bracha, but they're not obligated to do so. When it comes to Kiddush, the Gemara says that's not true. That obligation, as are all the obligations of Shabbos, whether it's having three meals on Shabbos, or whether it's using lechem mishnah, two loaves of bread, those are obligations that apply to men and to women equally. There are no differences in all the halachos of Shabbos between men and women, not only when it comes to the mitzvahs losasei, to refraining from doing any labor on Shabbos, but even when it comes to the positive elements of making kiddush, having a festive meal, having lechem mishnah, two loaves of bread, those are obligations that apply to everyone. This is the mitzvah of Kiddush. The Rambam says its source is from the pasuk of Zachor es yom ha-Shabbos l'kadsho, that a person is obligated to remember to mention that it's Shabbos. The Rambam writes a further Kiddush. The Rambam tells us that this obligation of Zachor es yom ha-Shabbos l'kadsho, to remember and to set aside Shabbos from the rest of the days of the week, not only refers to Kiddush, but also applies to Havdalah. The mitzvah, the Rambam says, of Zachar tells us that we have to make sure to mention that Shabbos is different from a regular day of the week. How do you do this? Bechnisaso, when Shabbos begins, uveyitziyaso, and when Shabbos ends. And this is what the Rambam tells us, that just like there is a biblical obligation of reciting Kiddush, there is also a biblical obligation to recite Havdalah. We mention when Shabbos begins, and we mention when Shabbos ends. And the Rambam writes, if this is true, that Havdalah is a biblical obligation coming from that same pasuk as Kiddush, then just as women are obligated in Kiddush, they're also obligated in reciting Havdalah. And this is the prevalent view among almost all of the Rishonim, that if women are obligated in Kiddush, they're certainly obligated in Havdalah as well. Because the Rambam writes, they all stem from the same verse. They stem from Zachar Es Yoma Shabbos L'Kavsha, to remember that it's Shabbos. And that means Kiddush as well as Havdalah. There is one view that disagrees. This view is in the name of the Or Chos Chaim, and it's one view quoted in Shulchan Aruch. He argues as follows. Havdalah is not a biblical obligation. Not like the Rambam tells us. When the Torah says, Zachar Es Yoma Shabbos L'Kadosho, that means on Shabbos, mention that it's Shabbos, recite Kiddush. There is no obligation when Shabbos ends to say, Shabbos is now leaving. That is only a rabbinic obligation. That's point number one which he makes. Point number two is that the Gemara says that normally speaking, when it comes to a mitzvah which is bound by time, women are exempt. That's why women are not obligated in the Lulav and Esro, not obligated in Sukkah, not obligated in Shofar. The practice is they do so, and women recite a bracha, but they're not obligated to do so. So, this is the normal rule. Kiddush is an exception. Because the Gemara says that Zachar is a verse that applies not only to men, but to women as well. So if you, as the Rambam does, that Zachar not only tells us Kiddush but Havdalah, so then women are obligated in Kiddush and Havdalah. But if you hold that Havdalah is not included in that pasuk of Zachar Es Yoma Shabbos L'Kadosho, Havdalah is only a rabbinic obligation, then the Or Chos Chaim writes that women are exempt from the obligation of Havdalah. And that's one view, a minority view that you find in the Rishonim. We generally assume women are obligated in Havdalah. However, there's one view that says that women are exempt from Havdalah. So we basically assume the bottom line as follows. That preferably speaking, that a woman, if she hears Havdalah from a man, she's certainly outside. Because a man is certainly obligated in Havdalah. Whether a woman is obligated is questionable. Those are two views in Shulchan Aruch. If a woman doesn't hear Havdalah from someone else, she's obligated to make Havdalah herself. And that's what we assume in Shulchan Aruch, that women should recite Havdalah, and if they hear it from someone else, they certainly fulfill their obligation. Otherwise, right, they make Havdalah themselves. This is generally speaking what we assume. I mentioned when it comes to Kiddush, that there is a halacha that Kiddush be b'makam suda. Kiddush has to be associated with a festive meal. This is not true of Havdalah. Because Kiddush is part of the Shabbos meal. You recite Kiddush at the beginning, and we recite a special Birchas HaMazon at the end. We add the paragraph of Ritzei. That defines for us a Suda Shabbos. Preceded by Kiddush, concluded by a special Birchas HaMazon. That's not true of Havdalah. Havdalah is simply a mitzvah. There's nothing to do with the festive meal. A person isn't obligated to come home in conjunction with the Havdalah to have an extra meal. So therefore, when it comes to Kiddush and Shul on Friday night, you can't fulfill your mitzvah with that Kiddush. Because Kiddush has to be in the place of the festive meal. So you go home and you recite Kiddush again. When Havdalah is recited in Shul at the conclusion of the davening, so with that you can fulfill your obligation of Havdalah. If you listen, and you have in mind to fulfill your obligation, and the person who recites Havdalah presumably is having in mind the same, that anyone who wants to can fulfill his obligation with that, so then That's perfectly permissible. And Kiddush, we don't allow it because Kiddush has to be in the framework of the meal. And the only reason we have it is to preserve an earlier custom. But Havdalah, that's a real Havdalah. And you can fulfill that obligation with that. But let's say, for example, a man is in shul on Saturday night, and he davens Maariv with the congregation, and someone recites Havdalah. And he knows that he wants to go home and recite Havdalah for his whole family, then he should have in mind that he is not fulfilling the mitzvah. That even though he's hearing the Havdalah, and even though he's answering Amen to each bracha, he's not having in mind that that is his mitzvah of Havdalah. On Kiddush, you don't have to have this in mind. Because the Kiddush isn't a real Kiddush. It's just preserving a tradition, preserving a custom that was done when people used to eat in the synagogue. When it comes to Havdalah, though, that you can certainly fulfill the mitzvah of Havdalah with the Havdalah you hear in Shul. And if you want to go home and you want to make Havdalah for the entire household, you should have in mind that you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of Havdalah at that point. Ideally, Havdalah is to be recited on Saturday night. After all, what better time to recite Havdalah than when Shabbos actually leaves? But the Gemara tells us in Pesachim, this is found on Daf Kuf Hei Amud Aleph, that a person has a few more days to recite Havdalah if necessary. A person can recite Havdalah Ma'avda V'holei Kol HaShabbos Kulo, which means a person can recite Havdalah on Saturday night, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Why? Because the Gemara says, generally speaking, a week is divided up into two parts. The first half of the week is the part which follows the preceding Shabbos, and the last days of the week is preparation for the coming Shabbos. So therefore, for a period of 3 days, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, a person is allowed to recite Havdalah. There's an interesting debate that you have, which comes up, unfortunately, quite often. It's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. What is the nature of this halacha? That even though a person didn't recite Havdalah on Saturday night, a person can still recite Havdalah on Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday. So one view is simply this, that how long is the duration of the obligation of Havdalah? It starts on Saturday night. And how long does it continue? It continues for 3 days. Very simple. Anytime during those 3 days you can recite Havdalah. There is, however, a view which disagrees and says the following. That in actuality, the obligation of Havdalah is only on Saturday night. That's when a person is supposed to recite Havdalah. The fact that a person, if he misses Havdalah on Saturday night, is allowed to recite it even on Monday and even on Tuesday is just a makeup. It's not the real obligation of Havdalah. And to borrow a phrase that when it comes to tefillah, it is called tashlumin, that the Gemara says in Brachos, that I'm supposed to daven Maariv. What happens if I fail to daven Maariv and I realize tomorrow that I forgot to do so? You can daven two Shmon Esreis for Shachris. The first Shmon Esrei is the Shachar Shmon Esrei, and the second Shmon Esrei is to make up the tefillah that you missed last night. Similarly, if a person doesn't daven Shacharis one morning, he can daven Mincha twice. Once for Tfilas Mincha, the second is a makeup. So it doesn't mean that I'm allowed to daven tonight's davening until tomorrow morning. It means that if I fail to daven tonight, I have a right to make it up, and that's called Tashlumin. And Tashlumin is not called davening at the appropriate time. The appropriate time really was last night. But you have a right to make it up because tefillah is like rachamim, it's asking for mercy, and you always have a right to do that. You can make up even a prayer which is missed. So what is the nature of this halacha when it comes to Havdalah? The fact that if I don't recite Havdalah Saturday night, I can recite it on Monday or on Tuesday. Is that because the obligation of Havdalah begins on Saturday night and it ends on Tuesday? Or is it no, that the obligation of Havdalah is just on Saturday night? And Monday and Tuesday is a makeup. So what difference does it make? Whether it's a makeup or whether it's all one continuous obligation. So in Shulchan Aruch it says there's a very important difference that comes up very often. What happens if a person is exempt from Havdalah on Saturday night? And then, come Monday or come Tuesday, that exemption passes. What's the case? The case is discussed in Shulchan Aruch as a person who becomes an Avel, a person who's an Onan. The Mishnah says in the very beginning of the third chapter of Brachos, that Misha Mesa Mutalafanav, if you have a person, one of his relatives has died, a relative that he's obligated to sit Shiva for, so until the time of the Kvura, until burial, that person is not obligated to fulfill positive commandments. Misha Mesa Mutalafanav, the Mishnah says, Pater min ha-tfilo, min ha-tfilo, min kriyashma, we call ha-mitzvos amuros b'Torah. A person is not obligated in positive commitments. He can't do something that is alos haseh. He can't start violating prohibitions of the Torah. He can't go out and eat something that's not kosher. But he is not obligated in positive commandments. So if a person's relative dies, and it is before the burial, that person does not recite brachos, that person doesn't daven, that person doesn't put on tefillin, that person doesn't wear tzitzis, not obligated to perform mitzvahs. Rashi writes, it's because osek b'mitzvah patur min ha-mitzvah. But since that person has an obligation to see to it that the burial is done properly, so he has an exemption. He's exempt from fulfilling other mitzvahs. But Tosfos writes, quoting the Yerushalmi, that's what we assume, that that's not the right reason. It's not merely an exemption. He's not allowed to fulfill mitzvahs. A person who is in such a state of agony, who has just lost a near relative, is not allowed to fulfill mitzvahs. Can't even do so optionally. That from the time of the death of a relative until the time of the burial, a person does not do positive commandments. Doesn't recite brachos, doesn't daven, doesn't put on tefillin, doesn't wear tzitzis, doesn't wear talis, and so on. So the case that's discussed in Shulchan Aruch is this. What happens if, unfortunately, a person's relative passes away on Shabbos? And let's say the funeral is on Sunday or the funeral is on Monday. After the funeral, is that person obligated to recite Havdalah? So the argument goes as follows. The Rush writes that really the obligation of Havdalah is limited to Saturday night. The fact that the Gemara says you can recite it later, that's not the original initial obligation. That's merely a makeup. So if a person misses a mitzvah, you're obligated to make it up. If a person is exempt from a mitzvah, then there's no obligation to make it up. If a teacher tells a student that you're exempt from the test, and the rest of the class bombs, and the teacher has to schedule a makeup test, so the person who had the exemption doesn't have to take the makeup either. So that's what the Rosh tells us. That if on Motzei Shabbos, not that you missed it, but you weren't obligated. Why weren't you obligated? Because you were an Ovel, right, before Kvura, so then you do not have to recite Havdalah that week. Even after the time of the burial, comes Sunday or Monday, now you're obligated in every mitzvah. Still, you do not make Havdalah. That's the view of the Rush. And the Maharam disagrees and says that's not true. There is a continuous span of obligation of Havdalah. It begins on Saturday night, and it ends on Tuesday. And if at any point in time between Saturday night and Tuesday you're obligated in Havdalah, then you're obligated to make Havdalah. And this is what we assume la halacha in Hilchos Avdalah, Simin Shin Mem Aleph, it's quoted. And that is that if a person cannot make Havdalah on Saturday night because he is an Avel, he is obligated after the funeral to recite Havdalah. Until Tuesday, that is still Shabbos. That's for a different reason. The Gemara says in Sukkah on Daf Lamaches and Brachos on Daf Ches the following, that when a person has a mitzvah to perform, a person shouldn't do anything before he performs a mitzvah. Right now, it's Sukkot. And I haven't yet been known to Lulav and Esra. I don't have Lulav and Esra. So I'm sitting eating my meal on Sukkot, and all of a sudden someone brings a Lulav and Esra to me. So the Gemara says, at